Hi, and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK Police Force. Welcome, if this is your first time, and if you're listening to the series, then welcome back. Hopefully you've been enjoying it. You may want to start from the beginning if you've stumbled across this, as this is episode 67, so we're quite a few into it. I think there's probably another 15 or 20 to go for sure. We'll see how that figure goes before I've told you most of the stories of my career. Thanks very much for the downloads. The time you hear this will be a total of over 17,000 downloads in total, which is incredible. Thank you. And some more people on Buy Me a Coffee, treating me to a drink. I appreciate that. Some good comments on YouTube. You can go on there if you want to add comments or ask a question, for example. So, it's all good. Thank you. So today we are going to talk about Grenfell Tower. Now, some of you, particularly in the UK, have probably heard about this, but from around the rest of the world, it's somewhere you may not be familiar with. Grenfell Tower was in North Kensington in London. And on the 14th of June 2017, it was a very, very large fire there, horrendous fire, lots of people trapped in there. And in the end, 72 died as a result of the fire. There was 127 flats in that building, 2, 3, and 4 bed flats. It's still ongoing today, the inquiry. It's sort of on the news in the UK at the moment because there's still various issues with it. You know, legal things take forever. What are we, kind of 7 years ago now plus? These things tend to rumble on forever. Apparently in 2015/2016, the building was kind of refurbed, and on the exterior it had a new type of cladding fitted to the building, I think with an aim of making it more kind of energy efficient and better insulation and things. But they now know, probably as a result of Grenfell, that, that cladding, unfortunately, in the right circumstances or the wrong circumstances, depending on how you look at it, can be extremely flammable, and not only flammable, but can actually apparently accelerate fires in a way they just didn't think was, you know, possible before. And all those things came together on that night. There was a faulty fridge, a refrigerator, I think on the fourth floor, which sparked a small fire, and from that it just grew and grew. And then once it got to this cladding, you had the nightmare scenario of all these people trapped in the building as the fire kind of ripped through it. Horrendous scenes on the news. I'm sure if you check on YouTube or Google it, you can see the videos. But certainly, there was lots of emergency services working on it. There was 250 firefighters. There was 100 ambulance crew there. Police were in attendance as well, obviously, mainly with the role of sort of keeping people back. But actually, there's some footage and some photos out there, if you look, of sort of the riot police holding the shields above their head and then walking fire crews and also ambulance staff across to try and protect them from sort of falling debris, that was on fire. A horrendous fire for sure. And it's a terrible place. It's still there at the moment. It's still standing. I think in 2018, they agreed that they would ultimately knock it down, although that won't be straightforward because they don't quite know, I don't think, how the extreme temperatures of the fire have affected all the sort of steels within the building. I'm sure there's plenty of experts out there that will know how to bring it down. And also it's surrounded, it's right in the heart of London. So it's very much surrounded by lots of other residences and things. So I'm not entirely sure what that will look like when it comes down. But yes, I'm sure there'll be the right people looking at that. So you're probably wondering, why am I talking about Grenfell? Bearing in mind at the time I was on the dive team, although don't forget we were the dive team and confined spaces team, so we went into all sorts of unpleasant areas, whether they were, sort of water-based or not. And we didn't actually think that we had a role there. We knew that it was from a police point of view because it ultimately was an investigation. And now I think as the investigation is advancing, over 7 years on, I think things like, you know, corporate manslaughter and things like that's being looked at. So ultimately, you know, the Metropolitan Police were asked to look into it and investigate it as a potential crime. So, you know, the same as if it had been a small, you know, incident somewhere else and you're doing forensics, you know, to try and establish what's happened and prove somebody's guilt or not, as the case may be. Grenfell was the same, but on a massive, massive scale. And with this horrendous backdrop of, you know, these 72 people that died. So the guys and girls that were there were, from a police point of view, were licensed search officers. We talked about them before. Very highly trained in real detailed searches, and are used to themselves, you know, in doing searches in very, very unpleasant conditions. But I think for a lot of them, having spoken to them, this place probably topped it for them. And it was very unusual. So firstly, you know, it had to be safe for them to work in. And that's quite difficult in a building, you know, like I've just described, that's been subject to these very high temperatures. So one of the things they did was they installed alarms into the building that then had like an audible alarm on every floor. And it was connected to various sensors, because what they were worried about is in high winds, you know, I understand that kind of skyscrapers, you know, this was a tower block, so not on par with, you know, like a New York skyscraper, but quite a big tower block, certainly for London. And those things, I understand, are designed to move a certain amount. You know, they're not completely rigid. They have some movement so that in very high winds, you know, they might move, I don't know, 2 or 3 feet to sort of absorb that movement and the forces involved, you know, with the wind. But of course, once you've subjected those things to high temperatures, how do we know how they're going to deal with it? And certainly the first few people in there, investigators and searchers, said that during high winds, the movement of the building was very noticeable. So what they did was they fitted these alarms throughout every floor. And the idea was that if the movement got beyond a certain level, and I presume it was in degrees, you know, if it went further than, I don't know, 5 degrees or whatever, this alarm sounded and everyone had to evacuate the building, because there was a real concern, you know, that maybe it would be unsafe and come down in high winds. You know, I think going forward, you know, once they'd had a chance to properly look at it, I think they realised that was unlikely. But, you know, it was about trying to keep the guys and girls safe. The other thing they did was, because it was so difficult to move between the floors in the conventional way, obviously the lifts didn't operate and were burnt out, but the stairwells as well were full of a lot of debris, you know, that you couldn't sort of, you know, easily move up and down in the building. So they actually fitted a completely exterior lift onto the side of the building so that searchers could go up and down in that lift to get access to the different floors. And then began for the police, you know, the really unpleasant, difficult task of searching through these flats, you know, not just for evidence, but unfortunately, you know, as we've already talked about, lots of people died. And to start with, you know, it was unclear as to who was in the building, because it was discovered that, you know, what was maybe a 2-bed flat, and you might expect, you know, well, obviously it could be various combinations, couldn't there? There could be, you know, 2 people with a room each. There could be, you know, a couple with a child, you know, there could be all sorts. And especially when you look at the 4-bed flats, you know, was that just one in each room individually? But the issue was a lot of them were sublet. And unfortunately, they knew that some had been sublet to unscrupulous landlords that had kind of packed people in like sardines, you know. So you might have a 2-bed flat that has, you know, 10 people living in it because they're sleeping in the corner of a room each, you know, and it's 4 to a bedroom and stuff, you know. That was a big unknown, you know. They just didn't know how many was in there. So the search had to be really thorough. And then even more difficult task was if you actually found remains of a person, to try and then ID them. So what they did was they brought in a couple of specialist teams. Obviously, the searchers are in there doing the searching. And a lot of those people, but not exclusively, are also in a team that's run nationally. The Met have a big element of it, but every force in the country, is my understanding, has people in it. And it's something you can volunteer for. You go away and do a course, and it's actually called the DVI team. So that's disaster victim identification, and they get used all around the world. You'd be surprised at the things they do. And a classic example was the tsunami in Thailand, if you remember that one back on Boxing Day, all those years ago, you know, hundreds if not thousands of fatalities there. And, you know, to put that all on one country with no resources and in the state of chaos it was in, you know, it just couldn't cope. And this DVI team was set up to go anywhere in the world to assist with sort of large scale disasters, really, and identifying bodies, you know. So they did a lot of training around that. And yes, some of them did go to the tsunami and were there for weeks and months, I believe, in assisting with recovering bodies. And then, you know, how do you identify all these bodies? Well, there's various ways. And how do you find them? Well, sort of searching by hand, fingertip searching is one option. You can use dogs, and certainly around the world, and there's earthquakes and things, you quite often see the sort of rescue dogs used. But it can come down to fingerprints, forensic dentistry, and anthropologists, and DNA as well. Some countries don't have quite such a, you know, perhaps advanced DNA capabilities as the UK, but there is still some, you know. And also you can do familial DNA. So, for example, if you've got, you know, a woman saying that her husband's been lost, you know, in the tsunami, for example, and you think you found her husband, you know, you can take DNA from her, and sorry, no, that wouldn't work. It would have to be a member of the family. So, for example, you know, son, brother. That's why it's familial DNA. Sorry, I got a bit confused there briefly. So you'd have to take that DNA from another family member. You'd then be able to tie it in with the body you'd found and work out, you know, that that was their relative. So that was one way. And certainly anthropologists were used, and I believe archaeologists as well, in the Grenfell Tower search, which went on for a long time. I mean, police officers were there for at least a year that I know of, and it may have gone on longer in different roles. I mean, it swung into action the Met, you know, in what it does best at these large scale operations that involve hundreds of officers. And very quickly there was, you know, toilet set up, there was restrooms, there was canteen set up, you know, restaurants for people to be able to rotate through and have a break and have something to eat and drink before they went back, you know, to work. So it was set up quite well on the ground. But the basic premise was, when they got into a flat, and remember there was 127 of them, it'd be a team of four generally. So there'd be two searchers. There would quite often be like a helper. So there might be a third one, possibly a searcher, could be a police officer, could be somebody else who would help out. And then there would be an anthropologist or an archaeologist. And what would happen is, one of the searchers would basically scoop a bucket of, a spade full of debris and put it into a bucket. That would then be passed to one of the searchers, who would be sat on a little stool. And in front of them, they would have an empty bucket and then a riddle. So a riddle is like a big sieve. So like you'd sieve your flour to make a cake, but the, you know, the mesh is bigger. It's, you know, it can't be that fine because it would take forever, but it would be bigger that it would let certain things drop through. And that's how it went. You know, it would be a scoop of debris onto your shovel, onto the riddle, shake the riddle about and see what you're left with. And then the search officers were trying to identify if there was, you know, in that debris they were left with, was there anything that may have been human remains. And to assist them was the anthropologist and the archaeologist, who, for example, you know, they may see something that they believe is bone, and then it's passed, or it's, you know, all those experts are called in to have a look and say, yes, I agree, I believe that is, you know, human remains. So that would be documented. You'd have someone there, a scribe, that would write down the details, and that item would be bagged up, you know, and it would all be recorded where and when that bone, that piece of bone, was recovered and from what flat. And from then the records would be checked as to who lived in that flat, and had we identified the person that, you know, lived there, and had they lived or had they died as far as we were aware. And then that, you know, sort of background office work could kick in terms of helping to identify them. But really difficult task. And imagine all those flats. No wonder it took a year. You know, they had hundreds of officers on it. But, you know, you can imagine rotating round. I don't actually know how long each flat individually took, but if you're doing it one shovel full at a time, you know, and there is huge amounts of debris there on the floor, you can imagine the timescale, and a really, you know, unpleasant task that must wear you down after days and days of it, I would think. I think they were very careful to rotate people round there. So again, I've not answered the question really as to why I was involved. But what happened was, reasonably early, within the first few weeks after it happened, there were still quite a few people outstanding, i.e., you know, people that they believed lived at certain flats that weren't there, so they didn't know, had they died in the fire and been all but destroyed, or had they just simply been, you know, out for the evening. After a few weeks, it became more and more unlikely that that was the case, because presumably those people would come forward and identify themselves, say, I lived in flat number whatever and I got out, you know, or I was out for the evening or whatever. But you'd be surprised, when this happens, some people do take the opportunity, and I'm not saying this happened in Grenfell, but certainly I've known it before, sometimes people that are in a bit of trouble take it as an opportunity to disappear. So, you know, if they had debt, if they were perhaps, you know, having an affair and their marriage was breaking down, or there's various other reasons, but we've certainly had it where it's been, you know, very much hindering an investigation because this person has just disappeared, because it's a, they see it as an ideal opportunity to you know, to literally disappear. So that was a bit of an issue. But after, those initial week or two, there was one person in particular outstanding. He was a toddler, from what I understand. I never knew his name, but I think he was about 2 or 3 years old. They couldn't find him. They hadn't identified him. And the one place that hadn't been checked was the basement of Grenfell Tower. Now, if you imagine, you know, 250 firefighters, you know, with their, you know, hoses pouring hundreds, probably, well, definitely thousands of gallons of water into this massive fire to try and put it out. Yes, a certain amount of that water will end up on the floor, you know, on the outside. But if you're constantly, you know, running that hose in through a window to try and put the fire out, obviously a lot of it is ultimately going to make its way down the stairwells and end up in the basement. And in fact, that's what happened. The basement, which took up the entire, as you would expect, the entire sort of footprint of that quite large building, it was completely flooded, and there was basically a hatch on the floor outside the tower that you lifted, and then there was a set of steps that took you down into the basement. Now, in that basement, it consisted of the boiler room, effectively, but this isn't, you know, this is a boiler room on another scale. This isn't a boiler room like you have at home, you know, with two or three pipes going over it. This boiler, or boilers, plural, had to supply the heating and hot water, you know, to all those people, you know, 127 flats. So you can imagine it was on a massive scale, with, you know, pipes and, you know, all sorts of electrical items and, you know, stuff everywhere. Very, very sort of busy room. It was strongly believed, or they thought, that a possibility was that this young lad's body had been washed down the stairwell into the basement because they couldn't find him. And so what they'd decided to do was to call in the dive team to have a look at it and see if we could get into the basement. Now, you're probably sitting there thinking, as I was the moment it was, you know, I was asked to go and look at this, why don't they just pump out the boiler room, just pump the water out? You know, we don't want to put officers in there into a very unsafe environment if we can just pump, you know, the room out. But there was a reason why they couldn't do that. Now, I can't actually remember what it was, but at the time I thought it was a valid reason. It wasn't to do with forensics. There was some reason, basically, they told us, we cannot pump this out. We need it searched, and that needs divers, you know. So I went along to the location. I was the dive supervisor, and I went along with think it was my sergeant and maybe another supervisor, because we knew it was going to be quite a complicated thing to look at, and very unusual for us, because it was kind of a mix of both things. It could be confined space but in a dive environment, so, and we knew it was going to be challenging. So we went along, and this was my first look at Grenfell. Now obviously I'd heard all about it, I'd seen it on the news as everyone else had, but I'd never been there. I don't think I'd ever remember seeing it particularly, although I must have driven past it quite a few times. But one thing I will say is, when we turned up, we parked up on the exterior, and there was some gates that you went through, and then you go into the almost a small village that's been created with all these, you know, toilets and restaurants and a lot of, you know, things going on in terms of, people there, whether it was, fire staff, ambulance, and like I say, hundreds of police. But it was really quite an eerie place. When we left there, you had to leave the village, if you like, and kind of walk around a marked off area that led you to some gates. And on that gate was an officer, and they were recording everyone going in and out, because don't forget, this is basically a massive, massive crime scene. So like I said, if you put it to your small incident that they're doing some forensics on, maybe, you know, a nasty assault or something, and you would put an officer on the door who would record who comes in and out, the same thing was happening, but on a, you know, on an absolutely immense scale. So everyone going in and out of that location was details were taken down. So when we left the village area and we walked down this walkway, it was just the three of us, and I remember it was very, very quiet, considering how many people were there. I mean, obviously, in the location and given the scenario, you know, there wasn't like larking about and joking. People were being very respectful, as you would imagine. But for that many people being there, it really was quiet. And when we left that and walked round to the gates to get into the sort of site, there was no wind. I remember that. It was a very still day. And I remember sort of walking past or alongside the tower and looking up at it, and we all, the three of us, stopped for a second and looked up, and we all agreed, you know, it was just really eerie. You know, it was, you could see that, you know, the blackened and the sort of charred walls, and obviously we knew what had happened there, but it was just deathly quiet. And a very somber place. It really was quite an eerie place. And I don't necessarily spook easy, and I don't believe in ghosts or anything like that. But I don't know, it just had a real sort of aura or energy about the place. You know, not in a bad way, not a frightening way or anything like that. But just, I don't know, I can't really put my finger on it. It's the only time I've ever felt it, really. And I think it was just perhaps the enormity of what happened there. But anyway, so we moved on, and we were signed into the place. We went over and we spoke to one of the contractors who had dealt with the basement. And he had some photos that showed various angles from within the basement. And from a dive point of view, it was an utter nightmare. You know, it was just pipes on your pipes. You know, everywhere you looked was pipes and cables and leads. And that's when it was in a good condition. Now it had been submerged for a week or two, so we had no idea of what had happened to all that stuff. You know, there could be loads of stuff floating about in there. And we got the blueprints and we were looking, and of course it wasn't just, you know, a nice straight square or anything like that. You know, in terms of walkways, it was really complicated. And we really got our thinking caps on about how we were going to do it. It was going to be very difficult for sure. And we knew it was going to take a long, long time. And we came up with various plans of how we were going to mark where we'd searched, and how, you know, divers would only go so far before they'd search an area, then they'd come back, but they'd put a marker on, and we would then mark on the blueprint where they'd got to, you know, and just work our way through it methodically. One of the issues was that because it was a big square, the sort of furthest your diver would go would be kind of halfway round at the 12 o'clock position if you're looking down on it, and then he or she would return back. Obviously we didn't want them going the whole square, because, and there was such a high risk of entanglement, because don't forget, our diver is going to be attached to a line, so the chances of him snagging on a pipe, you know, or round something within that area was very, very high. And I must admit, I was really uncomfortable with the dive. You know, we do have the option of saying we're just not doing that. That is not safe, you know, and it has happened very rarely in the past, probably only about one or two occasions that I'm aware of. But, you know, we did talk around that, but it was decided, how on earth can we say that? You know, given the circumstances, I don't see how we can say that. So we decided, you know, that we would do it, and we'd planned it as best we could. And we went off. And what made it slightly worse for me as a supervisor, the other two experienced supervisors that had come with me on that day were both on holiday on the day of the actual dive. So I was feeling it a bit. I was feeling the pressure, you know, I was feeling a bit, you know, out on a limb. I was happy with the plan, but there were so many, you know, variations. I wasn't sure how it was going to go. So anyway, we turned up with the team. And I think they went off and had a cup of tea and some food while I went through again with one of the other more experienced guys to have a look at the scene, you know, and at this set of steps that, you know, and this sort of hatch in the floor that led down into the basement when we actually turned up, which I think was about a week later when we'd actually decided we were going to do the dive. And to my surprise, when we got there, as we were walking up to it, the hatch was open and I could see there was no water in the top of it, which there hadn't been, or sorry, there had been the last time I'd come back. And as we were walking up to it, somebody, a builder with a hard hat on, you know, fluorescent, big clumpy boots, came walking up out of the stairwell and off he went. And we got to the hatch and I looked down into it and I could see it was completely dry. And so we went and found our contact, you know, who'd been working in that area. And he said, oh yeah, no, in the end, what happened was we couldn't pump it out because of whatever. And we've been told 100%, you know, we will not pump this out. That isn't the way we're going to do this. And he said, but no one told, you know, one of the builders who doesn't normally work on site. So he just did what he thought was best, which from my point of view probably was, came up, threw a pump in there and pumped it all out straight into the drain and emptied the room. I mean, it must have taken like a day or two because it was, you know, a massive area. And that was it. So we were then asked to, because not many people had been in there, so we were asked to search through it anyway. And that consisted of basically two or three of us putting on a pair of wellies and kind of walking down into water that was now about 1 or 2 inches deep. And we just very happily, I was very relieved, kind of wandered round searching this basement. And bearing in mind, we were still looking for a young child's body. You know, we didn't have to be looking into tiny little corners. You know, he was going to stand out pretty well had we found him. But thankfully, we didn't. And ultimately, I believe they located him in one of the flats or his remains. And I think he'd been maybe visiting a friend, and this is what I was saying about when people were, you know, not where you expect them to be. I think he'd been round to a neighbour's flat playing with his friends, and they think he died in there, and his body was nigh on destroyed. There was only tiny bone fragments left, which is why it had taken extra time to then kind of identify him. I mean, it was a sad ending. Ultimately, you know, we knew he wasn't going to be found alive, but I was incredibly relieved that we did not have to dive in the basement, because it would have been a very, very dangerous dive for us given the environment, you know. So yeah, I was quite pleased about that. But yeah, Grenfell Tower, terrible incident, and yeah, as I say, a really unusual feeling there, very uneasy. At the building, perhaps as you would expect, but there we are. Okay, hopefully that was interesting for you. We'll call that a day, and then next week we'll carry on. Thanks very much for listening. Hope you found it interesting. Take it easy. We'll speak soon. Cheers. Bye.